Westminster Confession, chapter 5 and paragraph 5. The most wise, righteous and gracious God doth oftentimes leave for a season his own children to manifold temptations and the corruption of their own hearts, to chastise them for their former sins, or to discover unto them the hidden strength of corruption and deceitfulness of their hearts, that they may be humbled, and to raise them to a more close and constant dependence for their support upon himself, and to make them more watchful against all future occasions of sin, and for sundry other just and holy ends. Now, in this section, we're dealing with apparently unloving providences and God's children. Apparently unloving providences and God's children. Some people say that the Westminster Confession is too coldly logical. And you hear that criticism. Well, it's logical, certainly, but it's not cold. And it's definitely not lacking in pastoral outlook and pastoral instruction. The bulk of the men involved in drawing it up were pastors. They were ministers of Christ, caring for the people of God. And this is very evident in the Confession of Faith. First of all, the right starting point. The right starting point. The most wise, righteous, and gracious God. God's providence includes everything that happens, this we've seen. The things physical and spiritual. The inanimate world, the animal world, the world of men, the world of spirits. Everything is governed by God in providence, in the outworking of his eternal decrees. And though we may consider them distinctly as separate parts, if you like, yet, in fact, all is one glorious whole. Any homing in on particular elements of God's providence is to help us. But God's providence is one complete whole, one complete outworking of an all-inclusive eternal decree. Now, this section is dealing with God's providence towards his children when it seems adverse and contrary to their interests. At least it's dealing with a particular aspect of that. But it starts by justifying God, the most wise, righteous, and gracious God. God is most wise, righteous, and gracious. Whatever comes to pass, that's to be our starting point. Not always easily done because we're sinners, but that must be our starting point. If we don't understand, then we don't understand. But God hasn't ceased to be most righteous, just, and gracious to his people. So, however hard we find it to understand in relation to a particular providence, a particular element of God's providence, particular events, God is certainly most wise, righteous, and gracious. But then secondly, God's providence and the temptations and sins of his people. God's providence and the temptations and sins of his people. We're told that God doth oftentimes leave for a season his own children to manifold temptations and the corruption of their own hearts, to chastise them for their sin, former sins, or to discover unto them the hidden strength of corruption and deceitfulness of their hearts, that they may be humbled. In a certain sense, this is a development of the previous paragraph, because the previous paragraph has been dealing with God's providence and the existence of sin, and showing that God is neither the author or approver of sin, and yet sin takes place in the providence of God. And even in his children, God gives and withholds grace. He gives and withholds grace to resist temptation. Just as God may give and withhold saving grace, and gives that saving grace to the elect and not to the reprobate, even among his people, he gives or withholds the sanctifying grace of his Spirit in varying measures. The Christians do not all progress at the same rate. They don't progress evenly, and even our allotted span in this world varies, and the extent to which we are sanctified before we leave this world varies, and the rate of progress varies, and there are fluctuations. So God is sovereign in the work of sanctification and in the grace of his Spirit. And yet, and so we are to understand that even the sins of God's people, while still sins and still to be fought against at every turn, yet even these come about in the providence of God. And God works the knowledge of those sins for our good. 2 Chronicles chapter 32. 2 Chronicles chapter 32. And verse 25. But Hezekiah rendered not again according to the benefit done unto him, for his heart was lifted up. Therefore there was wrath upon him and upon Judah and Jerusalem. Notwithstanding, Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart, both he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the wrath of the Lord came not upon them in the days of Hezekiah. And then verse 31. Howbeit in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land, God left him to try him, that he might know all that was in his heart. So Hezekiah was left at that point to his own corruption and sinned in his showing the ambassadors from Babylon everything there was to see because of the pride in Hezekiah's heart. And it was in order that he might know all that was in his heart. There is a question as to what he refers to, God or Hezekiah. If God, then it means that, not that God ever has to learn anything, but that sometimes God is spoken of in human terms, that he would bring to light what was in Hezekiah's heart. Or else it can refer to Hezekiah, that he had to learn what corruption was still in his heart. Since pride is the essence of sin, self-confidence and self-flattery are a chief target of God's chastenings. 2 Samuel 24 and verse 1. 2 Samuel 24, verse 1, we referred to this previously. And again the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, go, number Israel and Judah. David later on learnt the folly of the pride behind that numbering of Israel. But the Lord withheld his grace. And as we say, pride is the essence of sin. Self-confidence and self-flattery are a great target of God's chastenings. For the believer who is proudly naive about indwelling sin is in danger of running headlong into a course of great sin. We need to know ourselves, and the believer who is naive about himself is in a very precarious position, a very dangerous position. And you do find that in the lives of God's servants, when you read the biographies of eminent Christians, you find that their awareness of their own corruption increases. Even though they are progressing and growing in grace, their awareness of indwelling sin and corruption increases. So that John Knox, not long before his death, said, "I have fought many battles, but I find nothing in my heart but vanity and corruption." Well, there wasn't nothing in his heart but vanity and corruption. There was the grace of God. But he was more acutely aware of his own sins as we progress in holiness. But the Lord uses our falls to bring us to see the corruption that is within us. The Lord allows us to fall to learn about ourselves, that we might not be naive, that we might not be unaware of the potential of sin still within us. The seeds of every known sin are still within our hearts while we are in this world. This self-naivety is illustrated in the case of Hazael, when Elisha told him he would set on fire the strongholds of Israel and slay their young men with the sword and dash their children and rip up their women with child. And Hazael, 2 Kings 8:13, Hazael said, "But what, is thy servant a dog that he should do this great thing?" But he did. He didn't think he would ever do that. When he was told what he would do, he said, "I'll never do these things. Am I a dog?" But he did do them. We are in great danger of great sin when we don't think we're capable of great sin. We need to learn about ourselves. We must learn the awful potential of our indwelling sin. And the Lord suffers us to sin, to see, to be shocked, to be alarmed, to be awakened, to be humbled when we see what we're still capable of. That doesn't make God the approver of sin, the author of sin, and it shouldn't make us complacent about sin, but it is certainly true. Thirdly, God's providence and teaching us to learn dependence. God's providence and teaching us to learn dependence. The confession of faith goes on, "and to raise them to a more close and constant dependence for their support upon himself, and to make them more watchful against all future occasions of sin and for sundry other just and holy ends." God's providence and teaching us to learn dependence. Children develop by becoming increasingly independent. They become less and less dependent upon their parents. They increase in the number of things they can do for themselves. But in spiritual growth, the spiritual growth of the children of God, it is the reverse. We're always totally dependent, but we progress spiritually when we increase in the awareness of that dependence. And the godliest man is the man who knows that he isn't naturally godly and depends upon the grace of God in Christ Jesus. 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 7 to 9. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 7, the Apostle Paul says, "And lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan, to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me." Here, it's not actual sin, but a trying providence that was used of the Lord to keep Paul dependent upon him. Despite his great experience, despite his great advance in devotion to Christ, even the Apostle Paul in this world had to be kept dependent upon the Lord. The fact that Satan was involved, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, did not alter, didn't detract from the good purpose of God in leaving him with this thorn in the flesh, whatever it was, and there's been much guesswork, but whatever it was something that Paul thought at first he'd be better off without. It was just a hindrance, a nuisance, something that was holding back his work in the ministry of the word. And yet the Lord said, no, it has to stay. Paul was peculiarly privileged with the abundance of revelations, and privilege can bring pride. And so Paul had this thorn in the flesh that he should know himself to be just a man and dependent upon the power and grace of the Lord Jesus Christ. We need to learn that too. And seasoned Christians are most aware of the potential for sin and their need of the Lord's grace continually. The confession gives also Psalm 73 as a proof text. We'll not turn to it just now, but we've looked at that recently in the services. Asaph had to learn not to envy the wicked. He was borne down with affliction. The wicked were prospering. He was tempted to envy them. But the Lord caused him and constrained him to consider eternal outcomes. So the Lord brought Asaph low, and brought him low in circumstances, and also suffered him to envy the wicked, so that ultimately he might learn to look at the long view and the eternal outcome of these things. Psalm 77. Psalm 77. Psalm 77, "I cried unto the Lord with my voice, even unto God with my voice, and he gave ear unto me. In the day of my trouble I sought the Lord. My soul ran in the night and ceased not. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Selah. Thou holdest mine eyes waking. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I commune with mine own heart, and my spirit made diligent search. Will the Lord cast off forever, and will he be favorable no more? Is his mercy clean gone forever? Doth his promise fail forevermore? Hath God forgotten to be gracious? Hath he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Selah. And I said, this is my infirmity, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember thy wonders of old. I will meditate also of all thy work and talk of thy doings. The process of affliction brought Asaph here to see more clearly, not to judge the Lord's purposes by the outward state that he found himself in, that his questionings, hath God forgotten to be gracious, and so on. He ends up saying, this is my infirmity. As he thought upon it and thought upon the truth of God, he realized that he was not to judge the Lord by the immediate situation in which he found himself. Mark chapter 14. Mark chapter 14. And verse 66. Mark 14, verse 66. And as Peter was beneath in the palace, there cometh one of the maids of the high priest. And when Peter saw, and when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked upon him and said, and thou also wast with Jesus of Nazareth. But he denied, saying, I know not, neither understand I what thou sayest. And he went out into the porch, and the cock crew. And the maid saw him again, and began to say to them that stood by, this is one of them. And he denied it again. And a little after, they that stood by said again to Peter, surely thou art one of them, for thou art a Galilean, and thy speech agreeth thereto. But he began to curse and to swear, saying, I know not this man of whom ye speak. And the second time the cock crew, and Peter called to mind the word that Jesus said unto him, before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. And when he thought thereon, he wept. And then in John 21, John 21, John 21 and verse 15. John 21, verse 15. So when they had dined, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? He saith unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, feed my lambs. He saith to him again the second time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? He saith unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, feed my sheep. He saith unto him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Peter was grieved, because he said unto him the third time, lovest thou me? And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. Jesus saith unto him, feed my sheep. The terms used for love there indicate, there's more than one word involved, indicate that initially Peter gives a very cautious response, as if he's learned not to, as it were, boast in himself. And, of course, he went on to be very bold in the name of the Lord. The same Peter who had been afraid of a mere maid saying, he's one of the Galileans, he's one of the men with Jesus of Nazareth. He preached that same Jesus whom ye crucified is made both Lord and Christ. Fourthly, God's infinite ability to multitask. God's infinite ability to multitask. You see there at verse 5, at paragraph 5, that it ends with, and for sundry other just and holy ends. If we can do two things at once or more, we now call it multitasking, a relatively modern and recent expression. But God so takes in everything that happens, and in all connections and directions, and in all repercussions that there are between one event and another. And everything is accounted for in the mind of God. There are no inadvertent effects. We do things and we aim at one thing, but there are other things that happen that we hadn't really envisaged. We have one end in view, but there are repercussions and reverberations of what we do that we hadn't taken into account. That's never true with God. All that actually happens as a result of a particular divinely decreed event is all decreed. You know, nothing is a surprise to God. With us, we do something and we scratch, well, we didn't envisage that, didn't think that would happen. That's never the truth, never the case with God. And so the Confession of Faith, very wisely, though discussing one purpose in particular, one effect of particular events, allows for others, that an event designed for the good of a particular child of God, for his humbling, yet God isn't confined to that. There are various other repercussions, but they're all just and holy. They're all just and holy. God is never, he never said, well, some of the, he's never making the best of a bad job. He's never, as it were, offsetting that, well, don't really want this to happen, but it's a necessary consequence. If we're going to do this, this is what must happen as well. That's never the case. All his ends are just and holy. And isn't that comforting? To know that God is so unlike us, that he has such infinite wisdom. And that's a tremendous blessing when our souls are settled in this truth.